Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. Syria's foreign minister says his country is ready to participate in peace talks in Geneva, but without any foreign interference, nearly a week after the United Nations Security Council approved a plan for an international Syrian peace process aimed at ending the civil war. Foreign Minister Walid Mualim commenting to reporters today in Beijing.
Syria ready to participate in the Syrian dialogue in Geneva without any foreign interference, and our delegation will be ready as soon as we receive a list of the opposition delegation.
Mualim also said his government hopes the dialogue will be successful in helping Syria establish a national unity government. The foreign minister did not explain what he meant by foreign interference. The UN Security Council yesterday gave unanimous approval to Libya's new unity government. A British-sponsored resolution called on the new Libyan Presidency Council to follow through on plans to form a new government within 30 days and make arrangements for its own security. Matthew Rycroft is the UK's ambassador to the United Nations.
The international community has today declared our united support for the Libyan political agreement that was signed last week in Skhirat in Morocco, and we've spoken with one voice in support of a government of national accord of Libya based in Tripoli and which the signatories of the agreement pledged to create.
Libya's UN ambassador told the Associated Press he would like to see the United Nations ease the arms embargo against his country so that it can defend itself against Islamic State militants who've now established a presence in the North African country. This is VOA News. Iraqi forces are battling the last remnants of Islamic State militants holed up in the center of Ramadi in the third day of a major Iraqi offensive as they fight to retake the key city lost 7 months ago to the extremists. Iraqi military officials say IS terrorists using suicide bombers and explosives, as well as snipers and civilians as human shields, are trying to slow the Iraqi advance. Meanwhile, the UN food program continues providing aid to Iraqi families internally displaced by the fighting. Many are Yazidi women who fled Mount Sinjar last year. Marwad Awad is a food program spokesperson.
The psychological pain and suffering that these women have gone through is beyond description, and WFP is doing its best by providing food to these families to ensure that they have the necessary nutrition to keep going.
The UN agency is assisting nearly 20,000 people living on and around Mount Sinjar. Meantime, the United Nations Children's Fund says 300,000 refugee and migrant children in Germany are not getting the protection and care they need. The UNICEF group says it is rolling out a package of measures to help fill the requirements. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
About 1 million refugees and migrants have arrived in Germany this year, although they have reached their destination. UNICEF says it is just the beginning of a new journey. UNICEF representative Sarah Crow recently visited Tempelhof, an old pre-World War II airport hangar, housing 2,000 refugees and migrants.
We're seeing very worrying signs about the exposure that children and women have to violence, to sexual abuse, to exploitation in these emergency holding centres, as well as while they're trying to be housed elsewhere in the country.
Crow says UNICEF initially will assist the government in improving standards of care and protection of children in more than 200 accommodation centers across the country. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The U.S. Embassy in Beijing is issuing an unusual warning to American citizens this holiday season. They say there's been a security threat in one of the city's most popular expat districts. Beijing authorities deployed armed security personnel to the Sanlitun shopping area in response. Lee Williamson is a magazine editor who lives in the city.
There were far fewer people on the streets today than there would be ordinarily. Beijing is never deathly quiet, but I assume it has to be the warnings that were issued by the U.S. State Department and by the British embassy as well, telling people that there was some security threats and advising people to be cautious and to stay away from the area.
That warning coming from the U.S., Britain, France, and Irish, all the embassies in that country issuing warnings. I'm Marty Johnson in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
So people are taking the most dangerous journey of their lives. We've lost 3,500 people in the Mediterranean already. People are going through transit camps that don't have anywhere near adequate facilities to keep children safe. We think children are the most vulnerable of all the refugees and migrants that we've seen across Europe.
That's Kirsty McNeil of Save the Children talking about the plight of migrant and refugee children. Details coming up. Also in the news, Burundi's government has vowed to crush rebel groups that have united under the banner the Republican Forces of Burundi. And the United States has condemned the recent attacks of violence in Djibouti and called for the immediate release of detained opposition leaders. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Burundi's government has vowed to crush rebel groups that have united under the banner the Republican Forces of Burundi. Presidential spokesman Willy Nyamitwe has told the French news agency that the rebel movement, like others before it, has no future. The rebels say their goals are to protect the population and uphold the Arusha Agreement, which helped end the civil war in 2006. They also say they want to oust President Nkurunziza from power. Violence erupted in Burundi in April when the president announced he would seek a third term. The opposition and others called that unconstitutional. Hundreds of people have died in violence since then. Meanwhile, the Women's League of Burundi's ruling party is calling for a new mediator for reconciliation talks. The current mediator is Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, who was appointed by the East African Community Heads of State. The league says 5 months after Mr. Museveni's appointment, the results have been unsatisfactory. At the end of December, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda will close its doors. The tribunal was created in 1994 by the United Nations Security Council in response to the genocide in Rwanda. Geraldine Matiolu Zeltner is the advocacy director for Human Rights Watch. Reporter William Eagle asked her about the legacy of the court.
I think one of the greatest successes and an important contribution of the Rwandan court was that it represents really a cultural shift. Until that time in the 90s, a lot of crimes were committed and those responsible were always able to escape punishment. With the creation of the tribunal, there's a strong signal that atrocities won't be tolerated. This tribunal actually managed to prosecute a great number of those most responsible for the crimes. In Rwanda, it indicted 93 people and condemned 61, acquitted 14. So in this way, the tribunal did contribute to establish the truth and to show how the genocide was organized in Rwanda, and therefore also to give some measure of justice for the victims.
I understand that there are still some who are waiting to be tried in other courts. If there are more perpetrators out there, why close the court now?
Yes, 9 people in total indicted by the tribunal have managed to escape justice, meaning that they're hiding. They're somewhere where it hasn't been possible yet to arrest them. Of these 9 people, 6 cases were referred by the tribunal to the Rwandan justice system. So that means there's an agreement that if they are ever arrested, their case would be tried before Rwandan courts. But there are 3 people, including the former defense minister of Rwanda, who are considered high-level Rwandan official and who would be tried by the tribunal if they are arrested. So the tribunal is closing at the end of the year, but it leaves what is called the residual mechanism, which could try these people in case they are arrested.
You've mentioned some of the successes of the court. What have been some of the criticisms of it?
There has been a lot of criticism made of the International Tribunal. The Rwandans, for example, criticized that it was located outside of the country and therefore felt really removed and far away from the victims and those who were interested in his proceedings. The tribunal was also criticized for handling a pretty small number of perpetrators at the end of the day and for having pretty lengthy proceedings with quite high administrative costs. So those are some of the criticisms that have been made. For us at Human Rights Watch, we believe probably one of the biggest failure of this tribunal has been to not try one single case related to crimes committed by the Rwandan Patriotic Front. The Rwandan Patriotic Front was an armed group led by Paul Kagame, who has been the president of Rwanda for a number of years now, since the end of the genocide. This group ended the genocide, but in doing so, it also committed a lot of serious crimes against mostly Hutu people in Rwanda, crimes that cannot be compared with the genocide, but for which there also hasn't been any justice. And it was in the mandate of the tribunal to look into these crimes.
If that was in its mandate, why did it not pursue that?
It would clearly have made the relationship with the Rwandan government very difficult. And the Rwandan government made very clear that it would stop completely cooperation in all of the other genocide cases if the tribunal was prosecuting this kind of cases. So it does look like the tribunal basically give priority to securing further cooperation by the Rwandans in their existing cases rather than prosecuting those RPF cases.
That was Geraldine Mattioli-Zeltner of Human Rights Watch. She was speaking to VOA's William Eagle. On December 17th, Kaduna state officials in northern Nigeria announced they were launching an inquiry into 3 days of violence between the military and a Shia Muslim community. The violence erupted December 12th when residents of the town of Zaria set up roadblocks and threw stones at an army convoy. The army calls it an attempted assassination on the army chief of staff. Human Rights Watch says at least 300 members of the Islamic Movement of Nigeria were killed. The rights group calls the military response to the roadblock wholly unjustified. The Shiite leader of the movement, Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zakzaki, has been detained. VOA's David Arnold spoke with reporter Yinka Adiparusi in Nigeria's capital, Abuja, about the status of the inquiry.
Since that day, nothing much has been heard apart from the fact that the Shia group has come out to say that they will not be participating in any inquiry set up by the government because they have no confidence in it. For now, the state is arguing the issue, not the federal government.
And have they announced the results of any inquiry yet?
Nothing much. Not since the Shia group has refused to participate. We don't know where this might lead to. But again, in another situation which might set the government and the Shia group on a collision course, while attending a meeting just this past week, the governor said, if they find the Shia leader, al-Zakzaki, guilty of any crime, that he will be prosecuted. And again, if we continue the process and it gets to that level, then we might say that we are in for a really long haul of violence.
And what has the federal government said in regard to the incident in Zaria?
The federal government is keeping mum. At the moment, nothing has been said yet. Maybe they have own plan about it. Probably they might be leaving it for the Kaduna State government to handle it first because you might want to classify it as offense against the state. Whatever thing that happened in Kaduna State. So probably they are leaving it for the Kaduna State government to handle it. And then let's see how events turns out. And I want to say that maybe they are trying to play down the importance of the group. You know, if you bring in that kind of issue to the national level, you might be saying, okay, maybe the government is giving this group attention. So they're leaving it for the state to handle. And if, depending on whatever the turn of events, then probably in the future, maybe they might come out to make a statement or set up the panel of inquiry.
the Shia movement has refused to cooperate. So who is it that the Kaduna inquiry is talking to?
We don't know what action they are taking at the moment. We don't know. Because for them to really come out something concrete, it requires both parties to really participate fully.
And can you explain a little bit to me about the importance of the Sheikh in terms of Islam in Nigeria?
I can say that the Sheikh is important, very, very important to his Zazaki, to his followers, which are based in Kaduna majorly, and maybe some parts of Nigeria like Adamawa and some other northern states of the country. The Shia has really gathered religious force over the years, most especially in the northern part of the country. The Islamic movement in Nigeria is as high number of followers, as a massive followership in the country. The Shia, they have been very active over the years. They have had issues with the government, so they have always been in the news. We have so many important people, so many people of high reputation in society also being member of this Shia group.
And where is Zakzaki now? Do we know?
Nobody in particular can point to where Zakzaki is now. Some would say he is with the Nigerian army. Some would say he is with the Nigerian police. But we all just keep guessing by the day. But the first thing we knew as that when the event broke out was that the Nigerian army had Zakzaki in custody. You can say for now that the Nigerian army knows the whereabouts of Zakzaki.
That was Abuja journalist Yinkadi Parusi. He spoke to VOA's David Arnold. In related news, a human rights lawyer is reportedly calling on Nigerian President Buhari to prosecute the army chief of staff in connection with the Zaria violence. Fima Falana issued a statement yesterday calling for the prosecution of Lieutenant General Tukur Buratai and any other soldier involved in the deaths of hundreds of people earlier this month. The lawyer also called on the country's inspector general to allow those detained by the military to have access to their family, doctors and lawyers. Meanwhile, President Buhari says Nigeria has technically won the war against Boko Haram militants. The French news agency reports that Mr. Buhari claims Boko Haram is no longer able to mount effective conventional attacks on communication centers and populations in northern Nigeria. However, militants now often use unconventional attacks, such as the increasing use of suicide bombers. The United States has condemned the recent acts of violence in Djibouti and called for the immediate release of detained opposition leaders. Opposition activists in Djibouti say as many as 19 people were killed Monday in the capital when security forces opened fire on a religious gathering. A reporter for VOA in Djibouti says more than 10 people were wounded. The Djibouti government says security forces opened fire after being attacked by an armed group of people. It says 9 security personnel were wounded, but it did not mention any deaths. It describes the violence as intending to destabilize the nation and that it was orchestrated by malicious individuals receiving instructions from sponsors who act from abroad. The U.S. State Department has urged Djibouti's government to respect freedom of expression and peaceful assembly and association. It calls on the government to engage in dialogue to prevent further violence and resume talks to ensure peaceful and transparent presidential elections in 2016. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Nearly 20 people, including 6 children, died today off the coast of Turkey in the latest boat tragedy involving migrants and refugees. Rescue teams pulled 21 others from the Aegean. The boat capsized as it was heading for the Greek island of Lesbos. Naval patrols continue in the Mediterranean off the coast of Libya, as migrants and refugees also use that route to get to Europe. Yesterday, the Italian Navy rescued more than 100 people sailing in a rubber boat. It rescued more than 200 others earlier this week who were also in rubber dinghies. In much more positive news, a Senegalese migrant who was rescued at sea 8 years ago was one of the winners in Spain's largest lottery. The 35-year-old man will receive more than $400,000. The man, identified only as Ngame, says he is not in a rush to spend the money. He says he'll probably spend some for a good education for his son who lives in Senegal. Many of the migrants and refugees fleeing to Europe this year are children, and many of those who would drown when their frail or overcrowded boats capsize on the Aegean or Mediterranean are also children. The humanitarian organization Save the Children says, despite the generosity of many countries and individuals, too little is being done to protect the migrant and refugee kids. Kirsty McNeil is campaign director for Save the Children. From London, she told VOA's Jody Capua that when children are on Europe's doorstep, there can be no bigger priority.
So people are taking the most dangerous journey of their lives. We've lost 3,500 people in the Mediterranean already. People are going through transit camps that don't have anywhere near adequate facilities to keep children safe. So we think children are the most vulnerable of all the refugees and migrants that we've seen across Europe this year, and far too little is being done to give them the protection that they deserve and that any parent would want for their own children.
So many times we hear reports of people trying to make it to the Greek islands and their boats sinking, and many of the victims are children. What can be done to stem that problem right at the source?
So we need a response for the kind of problems that people are fleeing from. So again, any parent would do this. If you were in Syria, where schools are being bombed, where no neighbourhood is safe, of course you would want to flee. 4 million people have left Syria already. So we do need a political response that deals with the problem at source, and that's why it's great to see the political track of talks take up energy in recent weeks. So we do need to deal with the problem at source, but that can't excuse us from our responsibilities to deal with the children and the families that we already see in Europe and for which European governments have taken so little responsibility.
You're also concerned about the proposed detention of migrants. In fact, I spoke with the UN Refugee Agency just a few days ago, who says that some 700 migrants are locked up in Hungary.
So particularly our worry is about children being detained, which is against their rights under the Convention of the Rights of the Child. A prison is no place for a child, particularly when all they are doing is seeking a right to protection, which is the kind of Christmas gift that we should be glad to give. Children aren't coming to Europe to get our benefits or to get access to our housing. They're coming for our protection, and that's something we should be glad to give them.
So explain what you want the European countries to do regarding children in particular.
So we think there's five things that Europe needs to do. Number one is to maintain search and rescue in the Mediterranean, so to make sure there's adequate naval facilities to get children out the water if they're at risk of drowning. We need safe and legal routes into Europe that respect the rights of children. Proper reception facilities, so children are sleeping in puddles under wet blankets. They don't have adequate shelter or protection. Reception facilities need to be much better to deal with that. Fourthly, we need to relocate and resettle refugees fairly across the continent. But then, as we discussed, we do need to tackle the root causes and make sure that people have fewer causes to flee in the first place.
Now, Save the Children recently opened what's called the first child-friendly space in Germany. What is that?
So a child-friendly space is somewhere where children can come, and if they're on their own, they know that they'll be protected by our specialist staff. And if their parents are travelling with them, but their parents are too exhausted to care for them properly, their parents can give them to our child-friendly space, knowing that they'll be protected and have specialist support. So our staff across the continent at every stage of a refugee's journey are there to make sure that children have food, water, medical attention, someone to talk to about the traumas they've been through. So often when children get off the boat, some of them have been adrift for several days without food or water, and they have injuries that need medical attention. And Save the Children is there at every step of the way to make sure those children get the support that they need.
We're getting various reports of xenophobic action in some countries. Are you concerned that there could be violence against the kids?
Well, one of the things that's been striking about this response, actually, is the public have been significantly faster to respond than their politicians. So we've been delighted with the response of the British public, for example, who gave £5 million in a matter of weeks because they responded with great generosity and empathy to these children. So we see the overwhelming public response is one of empathy and kindness this Christmas, and they're to be hugely congratulated and thanked for how wonderful they've been, and I see how far ahead they've been of the political response.
Now, of course, we're on the verge of a new year. What are you foreseeing as some of the biggest issues in 2016?
I think most people involved in the refugee response expected refugee numbers to go down as we approached winter, because the sea is obviously rougher and the journey becomes more dangerous. We were expecting the numbers to go down, but actually they've stayed relatively steady. We've had four times as many people coming to Europe this year as we did last year, and we're not expecting that to abate next year, because while the situation in Syria remains so heartbreaking, people will continue to flee to get their children to safety. So we're expecting many more refugees next year, even through the bitter winter.
Kirsty McNeil is campaign director for Save the Children from London. She spoke to VOA's Jodie Kepawa. Cameroon is celebrating end-of-year feasts against the backdrop of skyrocketing prices. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé on the reasons for the cost increases and short supplies.
Cameroonians traditionally celebrate the end of the year with lots of eating, drinking, dancing and gifts. But this year is particularly difficult as prices of basic commodities are increasing. Housewife Edna Bantar, who is based in the country's capital Yaoundé, says she is finding it hard to provide for her family.
Everything you can find in the market, things are very expensive. A bunch of plantain that we used to buy for 2,500, now you get it for 5,000. Yams used to sell for 3,000, now you get it for 5,000, 4,000. Things are really expensive. There's limited stock in the market.
Cameroon imports more than 80% of its basic commodities either from or through Nigeria, but the Central African state has kept most of its northern border with Nigeria under strict surveillance because of the fighting with terrorist group Boko Haram. Businesswoman Kalbasu Anita says traders no longer have easy access to both countries.
In some areas that the authorities have advised people to pass where the borders are open, Boko Haram see attacks. At first, we used to just cross over to the north to go to Nigeria. But now you come down to Yaoundé, go to Douala, take a flight, go to Lagos, buy your goods, come back to Douala, take it and transport it by road to the north again. So it is very expensive. It adds a cost.
The increasing difficulty in traveling between the two countries is causing prices to surge on a variety of items and making it harder for Cameroonians to sell cereals, cotton and vegetables to Nigeria. Onana Emmanuel, senior official in Cameroon's Ministry of Trade, says the government, in partnership with some traders, imported huge quantities of basic commodities to supply areas where scarcity was reported.
Les questions pendant cette quinzaine, justement de faire connaître aux consommateurs.
He says they made sure enough stocks of basic goods were imported before this end of year period. He says they have been out to all markets in the country asking business persons to respect agreed prices and stop creating artificial scarcity that is leading to inflation. Cameroon has been fighting a Boko Haram insurgency that spilled over into its territory 3 years ago. According to the United Nations, more than 20,000 people have lost their lives and over 2 million have been displaced. Cameroon shares a 2,000-kilometer border with Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all others, Listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on The Voice of America. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Burundi's government has vowed to crush rebel groups that have united under the banner the Republican Forces of Burundi. The United States has condemned the recent attacks of violence in Djibouti and called for the immediate release of detained opposition leaders. And a human rights lawyer is reportedly calling on Nigerian President Buhari to prosecute the Army Chief of Staff in connection with the Zaria violence. Coming up, music from South Africa. And in our feature segment, Zimbabwe's opposition political parties call on President Robert Mugabe to level the political playing field. I'm Yehis Uhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the Sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Good evening, Yehias.
Sunny, I understand you're beginning with boxing.
Yehias, boxing's most ballyhooed bout of the year, Mayweather versus Pacquiao, certainly did not live up to the hype on May 2nd in Las Vegas, Nevada. The unbeaten Floyd Mayweather beat Manny Pacquiao by unanimous decision in the World Welterweight Championship fight. But in end-of-year comments by the VOA's undisputed and reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moweta said many boxing fans felt ripped off. In this Sunny side of sports highlight for 2015, let's go back to early May now and listen to what Namdi had to say after the so-called fight of the century. And our conversation begins with, good evening, Namdi.
And a good evening, Sonny.
Floyd Mayweather remains unbeaten. Unanimous decision over Manny Pacquiao in the fight of the century. First off, Namdi, I posted some photos at my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page, just dumbfounded at some of the reaction, saying Pac-Man was robbed and that the match was fixed. Did they watch the same fight that you and I watched?
Sonny, still undefeated, still a cash machine. I remember your old friend, the late Angelo Dundee. Floyd Mayweather did a number on Manny Pacquiao and made him look stupid. Box circles around Manny Pacquiao.
Lots of question marks after the fight, Namdi. The Pac-Man basically making some excuses, saying that he injured his right shoulder in training.
2 weeks before the fight and 1 week before the fight, it's my shoulder is getting better and better, but not really 100%, totally 100%. Recover, but at least I can use it, but something wrong.
Well, then why didn't they postpone the fight if he's not healthy?
Sonny, Manny Pacquiao and Freddie Roach both are sore losers, you know. I went to Wildcard Gym before the fight. I watched him. And on this show, Sonny, I told our listeners that this cat is not ready. All this excuse, shoulder injury. He didn't even talk about the calf muscles, you know, and all that stuff. A sore loser. He should be ashamed of himself. This is his last payday.
From my two cents, Namdi, when you get into the ring for a fight that's been hyped that much, you better come to fight.
Yeah, he didn't do nothing, you know. Mayweather, we expected a masterful technician Saturday night, and he delivered. Manny Pacquiao and Freddie Roach, You wonder what they were doing in training camp. You know, they were busy dealing with Hollywood celebrities, making all this appearance on Jimmy Kimmel's show. They had no plan B. I mean, if you remember, we talked about adjustments in fights, you know. Manny Pacquiao was just like driving a car in one gear. You know what's going to happen. You burn up the clutch, mess up the car. Floyd was able to adjust. And if you remember, we talk about Floyd Mayweather putting the early rounds in the bag, putting it in the bank. And that's exactly what he did and frustrated Manny Pacquiao.
Were there turning points in the fight where you thought he's got it, he's dominating this fight, and it's over?
Oh, after the first five rounds, you know, all these haters were the people that made him rich, you know, because they paid a lot of money to see him get knocked out, see him bloodied. But this man keep banking. So you can hate him as much as you want. He will go down in boxing as the best, you know. I even got a call from Lagos chewing me out about what I said on Muhammad Ali and Floyd Mayweather. And they said that the motor park fights in Lagos is more exciting. And I told them that, look, dude, the motor park fights knows nothing about defense. It's all offense.
And yet, I think you're right, Namdi. I think so many fans wanted this brawl between Pacquiao and Mayweather, but Mayweather just won't allow that type of fight.
Sonny, these fans paid for toe-to-toe. But we in the game, we saw this long time ago that there'll be no toe-to-toe. There'll be no Maidana-style one fight. It's going to be a fight with the smartest man in the ring with the smartest corner. And that's exactly what happened. Personally, me and you, we did not expect him to go there and look stupid and come out with bruised nose or broken jaw. No, Mayweather is too smart and too slick. He out-hustled Manny Pacquiao.
To the critics after the fight, Namdi, former champions Mike Tyson and Oscar De La Hoya, they both called it a boring fight. Your reaction?
These two guys are jealous because Floyd Mayweather, one night payday, is way better than what they made in their lifetime. They're jealous of Manny Mayweather, and they will still be jealous. He will go ahead and break Rocky Marciano's record, and they will still be jealous.
That's our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Mueta, speaking in early May after Floyd Mayweather beat Manny Pacquiao to improve his record to a perfect 48-0. On September 12th, the 38-year-old Mayweather announced his retirement in the ring after beating Andre Berto to improve to 49-0. Namdi says he's not so sure that retirement is going to stick, though. And Namdi says don't be surprised if Mayweather fights again in 2016 as he goes after that 50th victory.
Galala! Great show, bro.
Now let's go to Zimbabwe, where Michael Cariotti has a report on how some of the country's sportsmen and sportswomen are celebrating Christmas.
Viola Msariri, who was the head of delegation for the Zimbabwe team to the Special Olympic World Games, says this is the time to celebrate what has been a memorable year.
Christmas time is, for me, it's family time. So I take time to be with my family and celebrate and just give thanks to the Lord that at least we managed to go through another year and we're looking forward to yet another year.
On the other hand, the spokesperson of the Zimbabwe Football Association, Olisani Gwesela, says he will be on his way to his rural home of Jombe to join the rest of the family for a braai.
As per tradition, I will visit my rural areas in Jombe. That's where I will visit all my relatives, play with my old friends, people that I grew up with, our kinsmen, who are going to slaughter goat cattle. That is my tradition.
Even Zimbabwe Olympic Committee Chief Executive Officer Anna Muguni says after a hectic year, it is time to take a rest. Muguni says she'll be at a rural home in Chimanimani Mianikalen province with the rest of the family for a Christmas reunion.
We are going to go Kumusha, Kuchimani Mani, and go and rest. Just take a break.
However, five-time Castle Soccer star of the year, George Shire, says he will be relaxing at home with nothing serious to do.
Though I'm just planning my Christmas quietly at home.
But for World Boxing Council bronze belt title holder Charles Manucci, this is his time to go into serious training.
I'll be training because I've got 4 months resting, just taking a rest. But I think for this, I've started training past 2 weeks up to January.
Manucci is looking forward for a crack at the World Boxing Council silver belt title, which British boxer Amir Khan holds. Even the Secretary General of the Zimbabwe Volleyball Association, Ringisai Mapondera, says it will be sporting business as usual. The Volleyball Supremo says they will be busy.
We'll spend our Christmas playing volleyball.
These are the different ways in which people choose to spend their Christmas. Reporting in Harare, this is Michael Cariati.
Voice of America!
German basketball star Dirk Nowitzki moved into sixth place on the NBA's career scoring list Wednesday night and helped the Dallas Mavericks edge the Brooklyn Nets 119-118 in overtime in New York City. Nowitzki made the go-ahead basket with about 19 seconds left in the overtime period to lift the Mavericks to victory. Dirk ended the game with 22 points, giving him 28,609 in his career. The retired Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is the NBA's all-time career scoring leader with 38,387 points. Abdul-Jabbar is followed by Karl Malone, Kobe Bryant, Michael Jordan, the late, great Wilt Chamberlain, and now Dirk Nowitzki. Meanwhile, Nowitzki's teammate J.J. Barea scored a career-high 32 points and added a season-best 11 assists for the Mavericks in that game on Wednesday night. The other NBA team based in New York, the Knicks, were in Cleveland, Ohio on Wednesday night, and they also lost. LeBron James scored 24 points, including three key baskets down the stretch to lead the host Cleveland Cavaliers to a 91-84 victory over the Knicks. The five-time NBA champion San Antonio Spurs won their seventh consecutive game. The Spurs beat the host Minnesota Timberwolves 108-83. Kawhi Leonard had 19 points and 6 rebounds for the Spurs, who improved to 25 wins and only 5 losses for the season. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to you, Hayes Woohee.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, Zimbabwe's opposition political parties call on President Robert Mugabe to level the political playing field. And next, a new community-based currency in Kenya. But first, some music. Here is Yvonne Shaka Shaka from South Africa with Will Africa Change?
On en a marre de parler du passé. Ça suffit. L'avenir est tout ce qui compte. On a deux choix. La guerre et le désespoir. Ou le bonheur et le développement.
South Africa's Yvonne Shaka Shaka with Will Africa Change. Zimbabwe's opposition political parties are celebrating the recent signing of the National Electoral Reforms Agenda, or NERA, by the yet-to-be-formally-launched movement called People First. The group is said to be led by former Vice President Joyce Mujuru. The opposition is uniting under NERA with calls for President Robert Mugabe to level the political playing field, with key electoral reforms ahead of the crucial 2018 national polls. Meanwhile, various opposition parties and civil society groups are working together under the recently launched Zimbabwe National Agreement Platform. For commentary on the developments reported, Sandra Nayara reached out to political analyst Sydney Cheese, who's also in the Zimbabwe National Agreement Platform technical team, and Gaziri Chirumanzu. He's an analyst with links to the ruling ZANU-PF and President Robert Mugabe. Cheese starts by explaining what NERA is all about and why it is important.
My analysis of events in ZANU-PF is very clear, that ZANU-PF is an old president, and because of the age of the president, there is a struggle for power, serious struggle for power to replace the president, who may either die anytime or resign anytime. And the serious jostling for political power has led to an intense internal struggle, or a dog-eat-dog situation, in which a lot of people think that there is a possible chance to succeed the president. And therefore, they are also competing for the ears of the president. And this, therefore, has led to a lot of lies and told stories, with the consequent expulsion of members from ZANU-PF.
Your take, Mr. Madiridze, on what is happening in ZANU-PF currently?
This is normal to a party like ZANU-PF. You find factions coming up and others dying away. This is normal because ZANU-PF as a party is old. That's point number one. Another point is that the leader of that party is old and has been in power for too long, because there was no succession plan since 1980 up to now. There was no succession plan, and this is causing the development of factions and the dissolving of other factions. This is all because of the succession question. Once that succession question has been answered, we won't have problems in ZANU-PF. It will be a stable party. These suspensions and these expulsions will continue unless and until the succession question has been resolved.
Coming back to you, Mr. Shou, looking at what happened last year, we were all shocked when Mai Mujuru was booted out of the party. Do you see another shocker coming up or brewing up that we may have Mr. Mnangagwa no longer being the president, or the vice president rather? Do you see that happening over the weekend?
Well, the events in ZANU-PF are unpredictable. Unless ZANU-PF is self-destructive or wants to end itself, I don't foresee a possibility that the vice president, Comrade Mnangagwa, may be deposed, or that he may be replaced by the wife of the president, Comrade Grace Mugabe. I don't see such a situation happening. But you know, ZANU-PF is unpredictable. No one ever thought that ZANU-PF could expel the former vice president, Joyce Mujuru, former gurus like Didmus Mutasa, as other luminaries of the liberation struggle. My point is very clear, that elevating people with no liberation history, like the wife of the president, and relegating people with credible liberation struggle in spite of their cruelty, I think will be suicidal.
Coming to you, Mr. Madiridze, you were talking earlier on about the succession plan. Does Mr. Mugabe have a succession plan, or events are basically overtaking him right now?
He does have a succession plan, which he doesn't want to reveal anyway. This plan revolves around his relatives and those who come from Mashonaland province, those who come from maybe from within the Gushungo clan. This succession plan cannot be unpacked now, because the war veterans might not agree with the plan. They are the key stakeholders of ZANU-PF. And if they don't agree with the plan, the plan will be doomed to fail.
What are your expectations of this conference? What do you think is going to happen?
This conference is going to be an eye-opener to most of the people who are not aware of what is actually happening in ZANU-PF. It is going to reveal to us that the issue of factions, the issue of G40 and this other old guard faction is not just a thing of the private media. The divisions are going to be clearer than before. And if they are not careful, this conference might actually mark the downfall of ZANU-PF and maybe the downfall of other key members of that particular organization called ZANU-PF.
Dr. Shaw, do you agree that this could mark the end or the beginning of the end for ZANU-PF if things are not handled properly?
Unfortunately, I may not agree. One thing which I agree with him is that this conference would reveal the major weaknesses of ZANU. But I do not agree that then these weaknesses may lead to the demise of ZANU. You see, because ZANU uses the army to plan, they have several scenarios. So after noting several weaknesses, it may then give also Mugabe an opportunity now to consult the army to come up with a grand plan to force people into units under his terms using the army. So there are two possibilities, possibly of weakening it, but also strengthening it after realizing the major weaknesses dividing the country or dividing the people. Because they never listen to what the president does. Even if he starts getting people for being divided, he is well known for indicating to turn right when he's turning left. So there are two possibilities, of course, revealing the weaknesses of the party. That in itself is a threat. But at the same time, it may also, therefore, then give an opportunity for the army to come up with a strategic plan to ensure that they unite the people.
Political analysts Sidney Chisi and Gadzira Chirimanzu, they were speaking with reporter Sandra Niara. Several low-income settlements outside Kenya's capital, Nairobi, are using a new community-based currency. As Lenny Rovaga reports from Nairobi, the pesas are equal in value to the Kenyan shilling and can be spent in the community just like cash.
Here in Kawangware, an informal settlement on the outskirts of Kenya's capital, students make their way to Sifa Primary School. They pay their tuition with Gatina pesas. The school is one of several institutions that accepts the community currency. Teacher Josephine Ouma says the currency has made life easier.
This currency works in a way that it circulates. So as a teacher, I get it from the parent. And I still take the same currency back to the parents to buy their goods. So it's a circulation process that I don't think there can be any scarcity.
The NGO Grassroots Economics rolled out the currency here last year. The pesas are only valid here in Gatina Village, part of the settlement.
Community currency, as you know, is a legal tender that acts as a promissory note and works hand in hand with the national currency. So in the event a member has less of the national currency, they're free to supplement that with the community currency so as to get access to the goods and services they may need.
The NGO has given pesas to about 500 locals. Each member must be vouched for by four business owners. The members then receive a maximum of 400 pesos, of which 200 are saved and pooled for community improvement projects. The rest, they can spend like cash. But those 500 members are a fraction of the approximately 10,000 people living in Gatina Village.
There are some challenges with the currency, since there are a lot of people here who have not accepted its use, but I believe that once we educate them on it, they will accept it, since many more are joining as we continue to enlighten.
The NGO says it started with a small number of members to make monitoring easier, but experts note that community currencies do have limitations.
It prevents you from getting goods and services from outside the economy, the local economy, and that means that the exchange networks are often quite small. A second weakness is the organization. At the moment, a lot of community currencies are organized in a voluntary form, and often after a certain amount of time, the impetus runs out.
Grassroots Economics plans to expand the initiative to communities in Rwanda, Uganda, and Tanzania in 2016. Participants in Kenya say the currency provides a cushion against hard times. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Kurt Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The death of a mother is the greatest misfortune for a young family. When a woman dies in childbirth, the newborn's own chances of survival diminish tenfold. That child and any siblings are less likely to receive health care and to go to school, and the family as a whole is now more likely to suffer economic hardship. Yet every 2 minutes, another mother dies during pregnancy or childbirth. More than half of the deaths occur in sub-Saharan Africa. That is why in June 2012, the United States and the government of Norway partnered with the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the private sector initiative Merck for Mothers, and the Every Mother Counts campaign to found the Saving Mothers Giving Life initiative. Saving Mothers Giving Life is a 5-year initiative that seeks to reduce maternal mortality by half and improve health in places where women are dying at alarming rates during pregnancy and childbirth. It was initially implemented in 4 districts each in Uganda and Zambia, with a focus on labor, delivery, and the first 48 hours postpartum, the time period in which some 2/3 of maternal deaths and nearly half of infant deaths occur. Early reports indicated that the program was working, so it was expanded in 2014 to an additional 12 districts in Zambia and another 6 districts in Uganda. Now the program has reached its halfway point, and the results are astonishingly good. In Uganda, the institutional maternal mortality rate has fallen by 45% since the beginning of the initiative, and thanks to a strong training and educational campaign, by 41% at the community level. In Zambia, institutional mortality, meaning in a hospital or clinic, has fallen by 53% in the target districts, and nearly 90% of women are now giving birth in a facility compared to 63% at the outset of the initiative. As a result of this success, the partnership is expanding the program to Nigeria, a country that accounts for 14% of the world's maternal deaths and a quarter of the world's newborn deaths, with an initial focus on the southeastern state of Cross River. Surviving childbirth should not be a matter of luck or where you live or how much money you have. Together, we are working to make that a reality.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
VOA News.
When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.